Well, this week we're going to be looking into Genesis chapter 45. And I think in the entire book of Genesis, if I had to pick one that I would say, one chapter is like the Alps, the mountain peak of Genesis, it would be this chapter. You know, I love Genesis, and I have several favorite chapters, but of my favorites, this one, I think, is right there at the top. This is part of a Torah portion called Vayigash. Vayigash. Yigash means to draw close. And the Torah portion actually begins back in chapter 44, verse 18. Joseph has the entire scenario set up. He's gotten his 10 brothers to bring the 11th, Benjamin, to Egypt with them. And he sets up the scene to where now they can do to Benjamin what they did to him 22 years earlier. Or they can change the storyline. Now, they don't know this is Joseph, their brother, who's lording that over them and setting up this thing and being in a position to judge them and to hold their brother prisoner. And so in chapter 44, verse 18, it says that Judah, Vayigash, and he approached Joseph. Judah. He came to Joseph and how he had changed over 22 years. The same Judah who was instrumental in selling Joseph into slavery because he was so jealous of him. He just hated him. His dreams, he hated his father's favoritism of Joseph. He hated his coat of many colors, and they were going to kill him. They decided to sell him to these slave traders and never see him again. They dipped his coat into blood, presented to the father as if he had been torn to death, torn to pieces by a wild animal. Now, 22 years later, everything's set up to where they have a chance of abandoning Benjamin in the same way. And it says, Vayigash, and Judah approached Joseph. And you could read the story, and he says, let Benjamin go back to his father, take me instead. And he did this out of love for his brother, and out of love for his father. What a change of heart Judah had gone through. But 22 years, his entire willfulness and ego and pride had been broken. And now he says, take me, let him go. And at that point is when Joseph couldn't hold back anymore. He had to reveal himself to his brothers. Now, before we even look at the chapter, I wasn't even going to share this, but I just sense I'm supposed to. By the way, there's a wonderful book I just finished while I was on vacation. It's called Reading the Bible with Rabbi Jesus. Reading the Bible with Rabbi Jesus. It's a brand new book. And the author's name is, I think it's Lois. Lois. And the last name, I don't know how it's pronounced, T-V-E-R-B-E-R-G. Tverberg? Lois Tverberg, something like that. I'll make sure this book and the author's name is put on our website. Now, like with anything you read, you eat the meat, you spit out the bones. But with this book, the bones are very few and they're very small. And the book, the beauty of this book, it invites you into the ancient Jewish Hebraic way of engaging the scriptures. We Westerners and modern Greek thinkers, we come to the Bible, we read it like we're reading a textbook. It's not the way the Jewish people have been reading it for thousands of years. They read it in a different level, in a different way. And I don't know of any book that helps explain that and invite you into that way of reading the word better than this book by Lois. And it's, again, Reading the Bible with Rabbi Jesus. In other words, you'll get a glimpse into how Yeshua and the disciples and Paul engaged the scriptures and read the Bible. So, I'm going to use that method. This is not a method I've made up. It's an ancient way of reading it. And so let's just start. I want to introduce you to a word. The word in the middle there is made up of the letters Samek, Pe, Resh. And it has five different meanings, as you can see in the boxes surrounding it. You could pronounce that word sefer or sefer, and if you do, it means book. A Torah scroll is called a sefer Torah, a book of Torah, a scroll of Torah. But if you change the pronunciation, not to change the spelling, just change the pronunciation to sofer, it means a scribe, one who makes Torah scrolls and who writes books, a sofer. And the soferim are the ones who create the Torah scrolls. They do it letter by letter, by hand, and put the entire Torah scroll onto the parchment. But if you change it to a verb, saper, it means to tell a story. Now, there you have to add a letter to it, but it turns it into a verb. It's still the same root. Saper means to tell. Now, does it make sense that one who sofer, sefer should saper, right? I mean, it all fits together. You see how this family of words works. But if you pronounce it sofar, it means to count. I'm not quite sure how it got this meaning, but it could be because a sofer, when he's writing a sefer Torah, goes through and actually counts. He safars the letters to make sure no letters are missing. But then if you pronounce it sapir, it becomes the word sapphire, the gemstone, sapphire. Now, what's that all about? That seems completely outside the family of words, doesn't it? You can see how the four words in red all are related, but how does it have anything to do with a sapphire? Now, we know that in the high priest's breastplate, it had four rows of three stones. Each stone was a different precious stone. And the sapphire was the middle one of the second row down. So it was right there. But what does this have to do with anything? Well, if you go back a week to the Torah portion from a week before, if you're going through the Torah portion schedule, you know you would have been reading in Exodus, and you're still reading in Exodus, and you would have read the story of the giving of the Ten Commandments, and then God makes the covenant, and he invites Moses and Aaron and the 70 elders to come up on Mount Sinai. Here's the passage, Exodus 24, verses 7 through 10, and it says, Moses, then he took the book of the covenant. And guess what the word for book is there? It's the word sefer. He took the sefer, the Brit Sefer, the book of the covenant, and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that Adonai has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant which Adonai has made with you in accordance with all these words. The Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, these are Aaron's two oldest sons, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire. Sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. And it says that they ate and drank, but God did not lay his hand on them. Now, this is a very bizarre chapter to see the Elohim of Israel, to see the God of Israel. But he's standing and walking on, looks like, paving stones made of sapphire. And this happens because Moses read the sefer. Now, the way the Jewish mind works is he sees these two words that are practically identical. And he connects them. And then we realize that if we want to see the God of Israel, we must go to the place where he walks on the stones of sapphire. And the sapphire is in the sefer, because they're the same thing. If you want to see God, yeah, you can go be alone on a mountain or in a cave or whatever, and we can have a close encounter with God anywhere. But the place he promises we will find him is in the sefer, in the book. That's where you'll find him walking. And that's where you'll find him talking. And that's where you will meet Yeshua and hear him speak to your heart and your soul the things that you need to hear. Now, this reminds me of an interesting encounter some of the disciples had on the day of Yeshua's resurrection. They're walking to Emmaus. Now, these are men who had walked and talked with the Messiah. They were his disciples, and they decided to walk to Emmaus. And they're discussing the events of that morning. And while they're walking, lo and behold, Yeshua comes right up to them. But they don't recognize him. The King James says their eyes were holden. Okay, they were withheld. There was a veil put over their eyes, so they would not recognize his appearance. They didn't recognize his voice, his mannerisms. They thought, this is just a stranger. And the stranger comes up to them and says, oh, what are you talking about? Haven't you heard about the Yeshua who is crucified, and this morning he rose from the dead, and he appeared to people, and all these people saw him? You haven't heard about this? And Yeshua, you know, this comes close to bearing false witness, but he acted like he didn't know a thing about it. And then he began to speak to them. And it says, beginning with Moses, that's the Torah, and then the Nevi'im, the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. Now, the important thing about this verse right here is this. Instead of just saying, hey guys, it's me, he wanted to teach them a new way of seeing him. Did you catch that? Instead of just saying, look, it's me, it's my face, it's my hands. You know, he just like jump out, boo, it's me. He didn't do that. He wanted them to get to meet with him, to know him, to walk with him, and to understand him in a new way. And that way was beginning with Moses, the Torah, with the prophets, and all the scriptures. He's basically saying, I'll always be with you. I'll always speak with you. I'll always meet with you. But this is where you find me now. Not in flesh and blood. You find me here. And if you come in here to the stones of sapphire, you'll see me walking around in the sefer. You follow? The sefer and the sapphire are the same. Are we together? Now that's a very different way of looking at the scriptures, isn't it? But it's a very Jewish one. So are we ready to move on now? The reason I'm sharing this with you is because when we come to Genesis chapter 45, we're walking on holy ground. And we're beholding our Messiah walking in the sefer. In a way that I hope you can begin to appreciate is absolutely miraculous. Remember, Yeshua himself is not going to be born for at least another 3,000 years. And yet he's appearing here in great detail in the story of Joseph, in the guise of Joseph, if you want to put it that way. And now looking back into this ancient book, we can see our Messiah walking in the Torah. So let's see what this chapter says. Chapter 45, verse 1. After Judah came forward and said, let your servant remain instead of the youth. Let me be a slave. It says in 45:1, now Joseph could not restrain himself in the presence of all who stood before him. So he called out, remove everyone from before me. Thus no one remained with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. There is a day coming when Yeshua will make himself known to his brothers, the Jewish people. Most attempts at evangelizing the Jewish people have been utter failures. In fact, most churches have missions to people on all the continents, to all the people groups and languages. But you ask, what kind of evangelistic outreach do you have to Jewish people? It usually doesn't exist. And I'm not condemning. I'm not condemning churches for this at all. It's that witnessing to a Jewish person who knows the Bible a lot better than you do, it's kind of tough. And we've talked about why it's so difficult for them to see and receive Yeshua from a Gentile who's sharing. Do you know how Jewish people do come to know Yeshua? reading the New Testament scriptures in Hebrew, looking into the sefer, and seeing the Messiah walking on the sapphire, the sapphire. That's how they find him. So Beth Akun, we contribute on a regular basis, annually, to Hebrew scriptures, which is a mission located in Cleveland. And their only job is to give Hebrew New Testaments to Jewish people. And the stories of the Jewish people coming to know Messiah are phenomenal and miraculous and amazing. Just absolutely amazing. So Messiah will make himself known to his brothers. There's a day coming. He's going to remove the veil and they're going to recognize who he is. Verse 2, he cried in a loud voice. Egypt heard and Pharaoh's household heard. And Joseph said to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Now stop right there. If you were his brothers, how would you respond to that? I'd be shocked and surprised. But would you be happy or terrified? It says they were terrified. This is what it says. Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him because they were left disconcerted before him. I don't like that word, disconcerted. It's too polite. They were terrified. In fact, that word disconcerted is found a number of times in the scriptures. And in Hebrew, it's the word nivhalu. Nivhalu is found twice in the Torah. It's found in the Song of the Sea over in Exodus 15, after the Israelites come through the Red Sea. Here's a few verses. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom, nivlahu, were dismayed. That's still too polite of a term, I think. The leaders of Moab, trembling grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone. You get it, the flavor of this word by looking at the context of the one other place it's found in the Torah. So why would they have been so terrified? Because they knew what they did to him. And they know what he can now do to them. The only person in Egypt more powerful than Joseph is Pharaoh himself. And if Joseph decided to have these 11 guys, or at least 10 of them, beheaded, thrown in prison for the rest of their lives, made into slaves, beaten to a pulp, if he could snap his fingers, it'd be done. They were terrified. Absolutely terrified. But look what he says to them. Then Joseph said to his brothers, now remember, what's the name of this Torah portion? Vayigash, because Judah, Yagash, he drew near to Joseph. Now Joseph uses the word. He says, come close, Gashu, come close to me, please. Here he could have had them all killed, he's begging them, please come close to me, don't be far away. And they came close. And he said, Ani Yosef, your brother. I am Joseph, your brother. It is me whom you sold into Egypt. And now, don't be distressed. Don't reproach yourselves for having sold me here. For it was to be, and the word here is michia, which really means a resurrector. We use it in the prayers when there is one place where Tim chants that one ancient prayer, and he talks about how God is the Mechaya Matim, the resurrector of the dead. That's the word used here, to be a resurrector. It can also be a provider, a life giver. For it was to be a life giver that God sent me ahead of you. For this has been two of the hunger years in the midst. You know, hunger years, that's Hunger Games, never mind. The midst of the land, and there are yet 5 years in which there shall be neither plowing nor harvest. So during 7 years of tribulation, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. To the brothers who betrayed him, because Judas, same name, sold him for silver, betrayed him, sold him to the Egyptians. pretended like he was dead and gone. And during this time, Joseph rises to power among the Gentiles, takes a Gentile bride, becomes the provider and the savior of the world, because everybody in the known world is coming to Egypt for food because Joseph had provided the food there. And during these 7 years of tribulation, a change has taken place in Judah's heart. And Joseph reveals himself to him. What a day this will be when Messiah does the same and reveals himself to his brothers. We can count on it. It's going to happen. Now I have to stop the music for a second. Oh, Isaiah 30:20. What a wonderful passage this is. Although the Lord has given you bread of privation and water of oppression, he, your teacher, will no longer hide himself, but your eyes will behold your teacher. Isn't that a precious promise? But he goes on, and he says, for this has been true of the hungry years, but then verse 7, thus God has sent me ahead of you to preserve a remnant in the land and to sustain you for a momentous deliverance. A great deliverance, a great rescue. And now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. All right, now we can stop the music. He says, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth. God did. And to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. So the question is, how did you get there? Was this God's sovereignty or man's free will? Because I'm pretty sure I read a few chapters earlier that his brothers sent him there. That they're the ones who hated him, sold him, and sent him on his way as a slave to these slave traders. Pretty sure they decided to do that of their own free will, right? But now Joseph says, no, it wasn't you, it was God. Can it be both? In the Greek mind, it can't be both. It has to be one or the other. Either God is sovereign and we have no free will, or God is not sovereign and everything depends on what we choose. That's the Greek mind. Either it's A or B, but it can't be A and B. But in the Hebraic mind, which practices block logic, where A is true, B is true, and even though they're mutually exclusive, I can embrace them both. No, I just have to chuckle when people talk about Arminianism and Calvinism. One teaches free will, another teaches only God's sovereignty, and people have been martyred over this argument. If only they had Hebraic minds, they could say both are true. You don't have to understand how they can both be true. But I don't understand quantum physics, which says that this particle can be here and over there at the same time. The same particle can be two places at once. And whatever you do to this particle happens to this one over here, light years away. It's been proven. They know it's true. Nobody knows how. They just know that it is. We can embrace both. You have the ability to embrace both. Is God sovereign? Absolutely. Do you have free will? You do. Use it wisely. But you don't have to throw away one to embrace the other. Yes, Tim, you have a microphone. Wonderful.
I like to reconcile it this way, that only the God of the universe can actually use my free will and still be sovereign.
Sure.
It defies logic, but that's what makes him a God worth worshiping. Worth
Absolutely.
Understanding as the creator of all things. He is infinite. So even if you can use free will and it be planned
right.
In his economy.
It's true. So true. By the way, visitors, if you're shocked that somebody in the pew is actually speaking during the teaching, this is what we do here. All right? So if you have a comment or question, you raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. That's just who we are. So don't be surprised if it happens again. But thank you, Tim. That's so true. You know, if you go to the story of Yeshua, Judas was chosen as a disciple. Yeshua, when he chose him, knew what he was going to do. And Judas did it of his own free will. But if he hadn't, Yeshua would not have died and been crucified there on Passover. And the whole miracle of our salvation through Yeshua would not have occurred. Man's free will, God's sovereignty, yes, both. It has been proven, psychiatrists, psychologists have studied people who believe in God's sovereignty but not free will. And they become very lax in their observance of God's commandments. Everything's up to God, you know, and it's I'm saved, so everything's up to him. So if I do this thing I want to do, well, it's because it's his will, because he's sovereign. I don't have a free will. So they just que sera, whatever they want to do. But people who believe in free will but not God's sovereignty are found to be twisted in knots all the time. They're always worried about losing their salvation because everything depends on me. And neither of these are healthy ways to live life. But when you realize God is sovereign, yet I have free will, then you can live in a balanced way. So embrace both. Stretch yourselves. Believe it or not, you can actually believe both. You have to humble yourself and not trust in your logic to try to figure them both out. Just embrace them. They're both true. All right, where do we leave off? Let's pick it up. So we left off in the middle of verse 8. And so Joseph is saying, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh, master of his entire household, and ruler throughout the entire land of Egypt. Hurry, go up to my father and say to him, so said your son Joseph. In other words, look what he's saying. I want you now to approach my father in my name. That's exactly what he's saying. Approach my father in my name. Isn't this what Yeshua taught us? That when you pray, you ask it in Yeshua's name. We approach the Father in the name of Yeshua. And it says, God has made me master of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not delay. You will reside in the land of Goshen. Oh, guess what? This Torah portion is called Vayigash because Judah approached the Yagash to Joseph. And then Joseph says to his brothers, Gashu, come close to me. And then he says, you're going to live in the land of Goshen, which also means the land of approaching. Isn't that interesting? It's another one of those Hebraic things that you can trace through, but only in the Hebrew. You'll reside in the land of Goshen, and you will be near to me. You, your sons, your grandchildren, your flock, your cattle, and all that is yours, and I will provide for you there. For there will be 5 more years of famine, so you do not become destitute, you, your household, and all that is yours. Behold, your eyes see, as do the eyes of my brother Benjamin, that it is my mouth that is speaking to you. Therefore, tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and all that you saw. But you must hurry and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. He then kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. How did Judas betray Yeshua? With a kiss. But here we see a picture of Yeshua kissing Judah back in love. I'll let that sink in for a minute. See, the two stories are one. Yeah, separated by thousands of years. But God penned these, seeing everything from the beginning to the end. He saw it all at once, and he just put the layers together. They're the same story, separated over thousands of years. But we see here Yeshua, or Joseph, kissing his brother, including Judah. Afterwards, his brothers conversed with him. The news was heard in Pharaoh's palace, saying, Joseph's brothers have come. And it was pleasing in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants. Will it be pleasing to the Gentile world, the believing Gentile community, when all of the Jewish people turn to Messiah? I think there was a day hundreds of years ago when that would not be the case. We live in a day where I see among the Gentile church, Gentile believers, a true love for the Jewish people. And sad to think there was a time when it wasn't there, but that's just the way it was. But I think we're in a period of time when the Jewish people do turn to their Messiah like that. And he reveals himself to them. The Gentile, believing Gentile world will rejoice. They will rejoice. So, I keep forgetting where we leave off. So, verse 17. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Say to your brothers, do this, load up your animals and go directly to the land of Canaan. Bring your father, your households, and come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you will eat the fat of the land." And you are commanded to say, "Do this, take for yourselves from the land of Egypt wagons for your small children, for your wives, transport your father and come. And let your eyes not take pity on your belongings, for the best of all the land of Egypt, it is yours." The sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons by Pharaoh's word, and he gave them provisions for the journey. Now watch this. To each of them he gave changes of clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of clothing. Now he's been giving silver back to the brothers all along, but now he gives them changes of clothing. Now what do you notice about this? Why is this worth pointing out? Yes. Good.
Because
this is the first time I know about where I'm going to use the microphone. I think they want you to use the microphone there, Rick. Okay, Rick, go ahead.
If I'm not mistaken, this is the first time it's written that Pharaoh is saying he's commanding Joseph to do something.
Well, that's
the
true.
The other time, Joseph had been in charge. Yeah. He was only ahead by the throne.
Yeah.
This one time.
You know what? You're right. I hadn't seen that. Thank you. Great. Extra points for Rick. Super. But that's not the point I was getting at here. It has to do with the clothing and the silver. But thank you. That's a brilliant insight. Why do you think the clothing and silver is important here? And Adam, I see your hand up.
I'm just thinking about the Church of Sardis in Laodicea, where they're given new clothes. So an outfit that represents a new outward appearance. So kind of a change.
You're thinking way too deep. You're thinking way too deep. But yes, you're right. He does. I think it's the Laodicean church. She tells to purchase. They're naked. They need clothing and to purchase gold, but not silver. Gold refined in the fire. But something from earlier here in the story of Joseph and his brothers that I'm referring to. Bob has the answer. I can see it in his the gleam in his eye. I know he's got the answer. Go right ahead.
Well, what I see here is, in addition to him using a kiss in a good way, now what they had stripped him of, his cloak, he is turning around and giving to them.
Yes.
In a sense, what they had taken from him.
See, Bob, I knew you had the answer. It's exactly right. He is giving to his brothers what they had taken from him. They had taken his coat, stripped him of it, dipped it in blood and ruined it and presented the father and said, "Identify this if you please." And he says, "Oh, that's my son Joseph's coat. A wild beast has torn him to pieces." They sold him for silver. And now what does he give them freely? Clothing and silver. Now what kind of grace is that? What kind of grace is that? You know, the Messiah teaches us that if someone asks your coat, give me your cloak as well, or your cloak, give me your coat as well. If he asks you to go 1 mile, go a second mile. And to go overboard, even with your enemies. And here we see Joseph doing that exact same thing. What a gracious man he was. No wonder Yeshua is called Yeshua ben Yosef. To each of them he gave changes of clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of clothing. And to his father he sent the following: 10 he-donkeys laden with the best of Egypt, 10 she-donkeys laden with grain, bread, and food for his father for the journey. And he sent off his brothers, and they went. He said to them, "Do not become agitated on the way." Or you could translate that, "Do not become agitated with the way." Sometimes I get agitated with the way. I know God's given me a path to walk. I become agitated with it. He says, don't. Sometimes I try to do well and I grow weary in well-doing. And the word says, don't grow weary in well-doing. Just don't. You know how many times you get agitated, and then you just tell yourself, don't be agitated. Or you grow tired, then you tell yourself, don't be tired. I think somehow we've lost the ability to tell ourselves, we don't have to be tired, and we don't have to be agitated. Don't cave into your feelings so easily. And I don't think many of you do. But it seems like we live in a world of wusses anymore. People feel something, they just give in to it. Don't do that. Rise above it. Stand up on your hind legs and be a man, be a woman. Set an example. You can do it. You really can. And I see Mim's hand up. So let's get a microphone to Mim here. Oop. Did it go off? Don't you hate when that happens? All right. Just shout it out and I'll repeat it. How's that sound? Oh, it's working now. There we go. All right.
As you were teaching when Joseph brother came, the way God put him, the second of Pharaoh, he can have all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Just
snuffed out.
Be away from him. And as you were teaching, I have John 10:10 in my mind that, you know, Satan come to kill, steal, and destroy. I have come to give life, Yeshua said, and life abundant. So what Joseph did to them is extending life.
Yes.
And more life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what forgiveness does.
That's what it does.
You are siding with God and giving others life.
Yes.
And Joseph had that power in his hand to do life or to take away their life, but
yeah.
He chose to do that.
That's so true. That's such a beautiful insight. Here's how you can tell when you've reached spiritual maturity. When people who hate you can inflict suffering upon you, and then you use that suffering to bring life back to them. Now, when you reach that point, you're walking in the steps of Yeshua. Yeah, thank you, Mim. And then we'll go with Sharon, then we'll get back to this portion so we don't go over time too much. There we go. Okay, Sharon.
I think that there might be another way to look at this particular verse. I think Joseph was telling his brothers, you had a long trip back to Canaan, a big long trip back here. Don't quarrel. With one another, no blame games. Let's just let it rest. It's done. It's over. It's a new chapter. Yeah. Let's forget the past and let's open up a new door of reconciliation to prove.
Yeah. And don't you know? Yeah, very true. Thank you, Sharon. And don't you know they're thinking, we got to go back and face Dad and tell him what we did. Because there's no easy way to tell him Joseph is still alive without telling him how he happens to still be alive. Yeah. Yeah, they had some confessing to do, didn't they? All right, verse 25. They went up from Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive. And that he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. Now that's, how do you go to make that flip-flop? In your mind, your beloved son is dead, torn to death by beast. 22 years ago, it happened, it's done. The beloved said, no, he's alive and he's ruling Egypt. How do you even make that transition? How do you do that? But his heart rejected it. For he could not believe them. However, when they related to him all the words that Joseph had spoken to them, and he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to transport him, then the spirit of their father, Jacob, was revived. Can you imagine what it would be when the realization comes to the Jewish people, the people of Jacob, that Yeshua that was crucified 2,000 years ago is alive. And he's the one that all these goyim have been looking up to all these years and telling us we need to accept. How do you make that transition? Yeah, it's going to happen. How's it? It's amazing. And it says, Jacob was revived and Israel said, now don't miss the change there. Jacob's name was changed to Israel many chapters earlier. But here he's called Jacob and now he's called Israel. Jacob was revived and Israel said, how great my son Joseph still lives. I shall go and see him before I die. I want to share with you a little bit about one of the characters I stand in awe of in history. His name is Rabbi Eliyahu ben Shlomo Zalman, and he was better known as the Vilna Gaon. The word Gaon means the majesty or splendor, but it was a term that was applied to a genius, a Torah genius. He lived from 1720 to 1797. Let me tell you a little bit about how bright this man was. And then I'll tell you why I'm sharing with you about him. This is the Vilna Gaon. By the age of 4, he had committed the Tanakh to memory. Now that's the entire Old Testament, memorized. Age 4. That's when I was starting to learn my colors, you know? At the age of 7, he was taught Talmud by Moses Margalit, rabbi of Kadania, and the author of a commentary to the Jerusalem Talmud. But anyways, he was taught the Talmud when he was 7. The young Eliyahu is said to have already known several of the Talmudic tractates by heart. He is known for having possessed an eidetic memory. He had a photographic memory. By 8, he was studying astronomy during his free time. From the age of 10, he continued his studies without the aid of a teacher due to his knowledge already surpassing all his teachers. By the age of 11, he committed the entire Talmud to memory. How many volumes of Talmud? 60-some? It's much longer than the Bible. He's 11. They can't even find teachers who can teach him when he's 10 years old. Reminds me of Caleb when he came home from first grade and he says, you know what? My teacher thinks she knows more than I do. He said that. Well, here, the Vilna Gaon could actually say, you know, these teachers, they don't know as what I know. They didn't. He was an incredible genius. Let me just relate this quick historical anecdote. It says, once upon passing through Berlin, the center of academic enlightenment, the Gaon was a Shabbat guest at the home of the Jewish community's wealthiest, most respected communal leader, Rabbi Yaakov Zvi of Berlin. A Gentile neighbor who was a leading professor and head of Berlin's 3 universities inquired about all the commotion that the Jews were making in their preparations to welcome the Vilna Gaon. Rabbi Zvi replied that a great genius was to be hosted in his house, who was a master of all the sciences as well as being a holy man and great Torah sage. The Vilna Gaon arrived on Friday afternoon. He spent, you know, all Shabbat there. And so when it came to sundown, to skip ahead, this neighbor, the guy who oversaw these 3 universities in Berlin, asked if he could take a moment of time and talk to the Gaon because he had a question. So they asked the Vilna Gaon if he would be willing to spend some time with this professor. And he remarked that, in his opinion, the great mitzvah sanctifying God's name and engendering respect for the Jewish people was at stake here, so the Gaon agreed. The professor arrived just as the Shabbat ended and the Havdalah ceremony is performed. With the aid of an interpreter, he proceeded to draw a number of diagrams and notations related to the question, this question in astronomy he had. Along with these, he presented a lengthy explanation. The professor was overjoyed with what he heard. I'm sorry, I missed the question. I didn't tell you the question. He had this question about astronomy that had stumped all the astronomers of the age. And he came to Vilna Gaon, and the Gaon spoke to him, used illustrations, and answered his question. The professor was overjoyed with what he heard, expressed his profound thanks, and took his leave. As Rabbi Yaakov Zviv escorted him down the stairs into the door, the professor, his face radiant with awe, exclaimed, "Do not think that this guest of yours is of the human species. He is an angel of God who is at home in the farthest reaches of the heavens. With just a few words, he has opened my eyes and given me the solution to a problem which I was convinced could not be solved." The professor could not sleep that night, went instead to share his experience with his colleagues in the academy. Since it was their custom to grant honorary degrees to great scholars, they all agreed that they would gather immediately the next morning, together with the entire student body of the university, go to the Gaon and formally express their appreciation. When they arrived at Rabbi Zvi's home, however, the Gaon was already gone, and although they attempted to catch up with him, he was nowhere to be found. That's the level of genius of this man. Now, why did I go into all this? The Vilna Gaon, in all of his studies of the Word and of the Talmud and of the ancient Jewish writings, there was one chapter that mesmerized him his entire life. Genesis chapter 45. Especially the words we just read. When Jacob said, "Yosef beni chai, my son Joseph lives." The Vilna Gaon chewed on that. He thought about it, and for years he pondered on this and what this must mean to the Jewish people. This one who is dead is alive. Not only that, but he is a redeemer. And the Gaon never wrote anything, but he dictated books to his disciples. And there was one that he dictated to them, says, "Don't print this or publish or share it till after I'm dead." And in that book, this is a quote. He quotes the verse, Genesis 42:8, "Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him." It says, "This is one of the traits of Yosef, not only in his own generation, but in every generation, i.e., that Mashiach ben Yosef recognizes his brothers, but they do not recognize him." You hear what he's saying? He says, in every generation, the Messiah, son of Joseph. Now, what was Yeshua's adopted father's name? Joseph. Mary was his mother. Joseph was her husband. He was known as Yeshua, the son of Joseph, even though Joseph was not really his father. But since his life is so much like the Joseph in Genesis, he's referred to as the Mashiach ben Yosef, the Messiah, son of Joseph. And he says, in every generation, the Messiah, son of Joseph, has been alive, recognizing his brothers, but they don't recognize him. It says, "This is the work of Satan, who hides the characteristics of Mashiach ben Yosef, so that the footsteps of the Messiah are not recognized, are even belittled because of our many sins. Otherwise, our troubles would already have ended. Were Israel to recognize Yosef, then we would already have been redeemed with a complete redemption." It all triggered from that, "My son Joseph is alive." And that made that whole chapter light up. And he studied this chapter and the words Joseph spoke and his revelation to his brothers for years and years and years. I'm convinced that the Vilna Gaon recognized who Yeshua was. But he knew it wasn't the right time. And he also realized that just as Joseph had to reveal himself to his brothers, that somehow the Yeshua, Messiah, son of Joseph, would have to reveal himself to the Jewish people. And it's happening in our lifetimes. 2 Corinthians 3:14 to 16, Paul says, referring to the Jewish people in his day, "But their thoughts were darkened, for until this very day, at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it is removed in Messiah. But to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their heart. But whenever a person turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away." And I'm going to close with this. One more rabbi, one of my favorites, the Kofetz Chaim. How many have read his book? We passed copies out. Do you ever went Beth Akun back in the early days? He wrote this wonderful book about Lashon Hara, evil speech, and how to keep your lips from speaking slander and gossip. His real name is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. He died in 1933. I believe he too knew the secret that the Vilna Gaon knew. This is what he writes. When Joseph said, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, God's master plan became clear to the brothers. They had no more questions. Everything that had happened for the last 22 years fell into perspective. So too will it be in the time to come when God will reveal himself and announce, I am Adonai. The veil will be lifted from our eyes, and we will comprehend everything that transpired throughout history. The blindness of the Jewish people has been recognized by some of the leaders of the Jewish people. And they recognize that this veil, this blindness, will be removed someday. But with some of them, they keep trying to figure out, what is it we're blind to? What is it we're missing that's right there that we can't see? And a few were able to pierce the veil, even have it removed where they could see what they're missing. But the frustration for them was that it was not the right time yet to share. But more and more of the Orthodox rabbis are coming to faith in Yeshua. So many of the Orthodox in Jerusalem are believers. But they say, but don't tell anybody yet. When it's the right time, we'll step out into the public and let people know. But that day is going to happen in our lifetimes. And we're going to see Genesis 45 at least begin to be fulfilled in a very major and marked way. I'm really convinced of that. So this is holy ground. And I hope for a little bit, at least a little bit, you can see that in this sefer, Messiah is walking on the sapphire. And I hope you will look for Yeshua to walk inside the pages of this book. You want to meet him? This is where you meet him. Every page of the Torah, he's there. He's walking. That's where we find our Messiah. It's how we get to know him. Don't follow your own imagination. Follow what Yeshua has spoken to us, what God has spoken to us through his word. Okay? That's where we see him. Don't ever forget that. Seek his face. This is where you find him. And Adam will give you the last word. So you have to, there we go. Uh-oh, the microphone went dead again. There we go.
I was thinking, kind of in the sense of this context, how Pharaoh, who knew and had an intimate relationship with Joseph, really appreciated him. When the time came, he said, take the land, and he said, go. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to dialogue with a lot of Christians lately, and I've been just amazed on the spectrum of perspectives towards God's word,
yeah,
God's law, God's chosen people, and realizing that a lot of that, almost like a lot of the heresies that were battled against in the early church are alive and well and very popular now. Mm-hmm. And it's astounding, but I think that there are, sometimes I think about my role as a Gentile, and where I hope that at least some of the church will be to is that place, mm-hmm, to say, go, take your reins, yeah, take your gold, and go. I guess there's, at the same time, I have hope that of Messiah's revelation of himself to Judaism and reconciliation.
Yeah.
I hope for our own reconciliation as Gentiles, mm-hmm, those of us that are, to God's Jewish people, yeah, and the ability to support them in that.
Yes, amen.
And to be ready to combat where people, mm-hmm, attack.
Yeah.
And then we have a role. That's
right. Yeah. Amen to that. Amen to that. Yeah, over the thousands of years, Christians have not done a perfect job of representing Christ to the Jews. And the Jewish people have not done a perfect job representing the Torah to the Christians. And so we've developed these prejudices towards each other. But God's bringing the repair and then making one new man out of the two. And we're starting to see the Torah more clearly for what it is. And they're seeing Yeshua more clearly for who he is. and we're finding out that we're brothers, finding out that we each have what the other needs. It's an amazing time. Yeah, there's still those pockets of prejudice and blindness, but the tables are turning, no question about it. Let's close in prayer. Our Father and our King, we thank you so much for the privilege of calling you our Father, because we're your children. And of naming you our King, because we are your subjects, members of your kingdom. So Lord, help us to be people who emulate our Father as dear children. So when people see us, they'll recognize the family resemblance. And by living your kingdom, following your rules, people will say, I want to live in that kingdom as well. Because we live in freedom and in strength and in health, physically and spiritually. So Father, help us to represent you better to both Jew and Gentile in this world. And again, as I always pray, make us the people you want us to be. And we ask it in Yeshua's name. Amen.